Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's podcast on the history of actor training in the British Drama School. This week, my guest for a chat, is Professor Rosteen. Professor Rosteen is an emeritus professor of the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland, where she led the Centre for Voice in Performance for a number of years. And Ros did a very interesting thing, and a somewhat unusual thing, actually, in the British Drama School, which is historically very eclectic, which is that she pursued and explored a particular way of working, which was in itself connected to the work of Nadine George. So, and that connects to other things. So you're going to hear in this podcast, amongst other conversations, a conversation about tradition and evolution. And I wanted to talk to Ros about this, for lots of reasons, partly because I think she's a brilliant teacher and I wanted to get something of that down. I was inspired to reach out to her about this particular thing because of something I read in a book by Jonathan Pitches, and I'd just like to share a little bit of that with you before we get on to speaking to Ros, because it was very much on my mind. And it's just a thought. Professor Jonathan Pitches very kindly gave me permission to read this out, by the way. So at the beginning of a book about the Russian influence in Britain, a good book, I think one of a small number of books which I think are essential to read if you want to understand something about actor training. The book is called Russians in Britain, British Theatre and the Russian Tradition of Actor Training, edited by Jonathan Pitches. It's a super book. But early on, he talks about tradition and transmission, a few caveats. That's the title of the section. And so I'll read to you and then we'll talk to Ros. So he says, although there seems to be a certain solidity around both tradition and transmission as terms, some caution is necessary before proceeding. Indeed, Raymond Williams was not overstating things when he called tradition a particularly difficult word. This is me. Raymond Williams wrote a book called Keywords, which consists of a series of little essays on particular words which Raymond Williams thought or noticed had particularly complex, sometimes difficult ranges of meanings contained within them. And so he wrote a number of this wonderful book called Keywords, where he looks at those words, looks at the meanings, relates them to their etymology, quite a deep exploration. It's a kind of a fantastic book. Highly recommend it. Anyway, we're about to hear a little bit of Raymond Williams. Even if the etymology cited in his micro-essay on tradition suggests a rather straightforward and simple process of linear transmission. Not sure it does, but anyway, a good thought. So we're going to hear a little bit of Williams' essay. Tradition, from tradare, Latin, to hand over or deliver. The Latin noun had the senses of 1, delivery, 2, handing down knowledge, 3, passing on a doctrine. Interesting. It's not until you get to the fourth Latin definition, surrender or betrayal, that an inkling is given of the term's complexity and of its inherent connection with issues of power, exclusion, and intracultural exchange. I've got a feeling that the word tradition, which means different things to different people, that's sort of the whole thought, maybe is starting to acquire more of the problematic meanings that are contained within it, which are contained within it. Jonathan Pitches goes on to say, in a sense, all tradition is about betrayal, as it entails specifying a particular set of practices, customs, or beliefs that are deemed worthy of passing on. In doing so, it inevitably excludes other possibilities. Well, that's true, I suppose. You select. Eugenio Barber, great theatre practitioner and investigator of theatre anthropology, describes such a process in a foreword to the 1994 conference dedicated to acting traditions at the International School of Theatre Anthropology. So this is Eugenio Barber. Traditions stratify and refine the knowledge of successive generations of founders through their forms and allow each new artist to begin without being obliged to start from scratch. seems like quite a positive thing. So one more time. Traditions stratify and refine the knowledge of successive generations of founders through their forms and allow each new artist to begin without being obliged to start from scratch. So the tradition stratifies the knowledge of founders through their forms, and allows us to begin without beginning from the beginning, without starting from scratch. Okay, so I found that quite useful. He goes on to say, the central dynamic of tradition is thus made clear. The knowledge of previous generations in tension with those practicing within the tradition today. For this reason, tradition is very often juxtaposed with the term innovation, and the conflict within this dialectic is commonly described as keeping tradition alive. Barber again. Without such a struggle, artistic life collapses. The spark of life in art is the tension between the rigour of the form and the rebellious detail that shakes it from within. In effect, the term tradition swallows up the notion of innovation at its source, suggesting that the two are perhaps better considered as a duality. So tradition and innovation maybe, says Jonathan Pitches, might be best considered as a duality. I find that really provocative and helpful. I'm not going to talk now about my thoughts about this. Let's meet Roz and find out more about her and about the tradition in a complex way in which she practices. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy this conversation. If you are enjoying these podcasts, or even this podcast, and would like to support the show, you can do that in three ways. You could leave a review. That would be fantastic. You could click on a support button and support the show materially with some money. That would be wonderful. There is a cost in maintaining these and producing them. And finally, if you wanted to drop me a line about anything, I love hearing from people. I've had lots of contact with folk. I've enjoyed. My email is robertprice1869@gmail.com. That's robertprice1869@gmail.com. And now on with the show. Thanks for listening. So tradition maybe might be the thought, something about, or a particular tradition, maybe the tradition of Nadine's work in the British Drama School, but starting with you. So perhaps you could start by telling me something about your journey as a teacher, and then we can move into how you got to know Nadine's work.
Okay, well, I went to what was the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama. It's now the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. I went in the late 60s. I had the opportunity to go to university, and I had an opportunity to go to the drama school. And I'm just holding those two things because I might come back to them. But I chose the practical training, and I was allowed to come to drama school by my parents if I did the teaching diploma. There was a diploma in speech and drama, for which you could then go on and get your teaching qualification. And there was the acting program at the time. There was also a technical certificate program. In effect, the two, it was a lot of crossover between the two things. And we trained with the actors for most of our first year. And then there was a separation. Just interestingly, as a side note, Ian Richardson actually did the diploma in speech and drama, not the acting programme. So you can see there was a crossover. I want to say something about the conservatoire, the drama school that I went to, because I think it's crucial, and it's crucial to what we're going to be talking about in terms of tradition. The roots of the School of Music and later the School of Drama lie in the Glasgow Athenaeum. That's why it's called the Athenaeum Theatre. The Glasgow Athenaeum was set up in 1847 to offer young working class men, it was men in those days, educational opportunities for self-improvement. You could have lectures at 6 o'clock in the morning before you went to work, and so on. It's very Victorian. In fact, it was Charles Dickens who gave the inaugural address. But I want to point to that democracy at its root, because I think it's a very strong strand in Scotland, and I think it's a very strong strand in the Conservatoire. And I think it's not an accident that this was established in Glasgow rather than Edinburgh, as Glasgow has traditionally, you might say, celebrated its working class roots and that identity. So there's a democracy at the heart of it and a pioneering spirit. And I'll come back to both these things because I think they're very important in terms of tradition, but then what happens to tradition? So I went in the late 60s. I was actually there, or I should say David Carey was there at the same time. David, I think, was in his first year when I was in third year. So I was really interested in that podcast for a number of reasons, but to hear just to hear him talk about the things that we may have experienced similarly or differently. So I did the three-year diploma in speech and drama. You couldn't get a degree in drama in those days. But I did the diploma in speech and drama, and voice was really, and I'd never done any voice work before, but it was the subject that really was the subject of my heart. I was always interested in text and speaking and a great reader, all that sort of stuff. So really, I gravitated towards voice, and I loved it. And I can tell you what kind of voice training we had, but I couldn't get enough of it. So perhaps that was already leading me somewhere, though I didn't think so at the time. The voice work that we did was what I now come to see as the mainstream English tradition. And we had three voice teachers. We had Johnny Coulson, who was Greta Coulson's husband. And because Greta was, well, I never met, actually, but because she was the... I think the founder of, but certainly a principal mover in the new College of Speech and Drama, our other voice teachers came from there. They tended to be her proteges, as it were, I presume. I'm saying that, but I presume so. Jackie Craigle, who's still working today, who we're still friends, she was a voice teacher. And we had for a year Terry Woods, who died quite young. I don't know enough about Terry's background or anything, but he was a wonderful teacher in first year. But we did all the things you would expect, including at least being introduced to Rib Reserve, although you know that quickly went by the way. And I did phonetics. I did my international phonetics certificate at the time, and also at the time, Johnny Coulson was very, very interested in Alexander. And Alexander had just started in Scotland. And we used to go into his room and he'd have all the mirrors. And he was very, very interested in that. So I was introduced to that in my training. When I graduated, I went, like most of my year group, to Jordan Hill College of Education to immediately take my teaching certificate, which I did. But after that year, I knew I didn't want to teach in schools. I wanted to teach adults. If I was going to teach, I wanted to teach adults. But there was another very strong pull for me. And that was while we did this diploma in speech and drama. As I said to you, there weren't many universities that did degrees in drama. There were only a handful. There were about four or five at the time. And one of them happened to be Glasgow. And the then principal of the, what was the academy, Colin Chandler, arranged with wonderful Professor James Arnott, who ran that department, that we, on the diploma course, that we should attend two afternoons a week for lectures. We should have a background in history of theatre or history of acting or whatever it was, much to the disgruntlement of some of my fellow students. But we had a certificate in dramatic studies from the university at the end of it. So we had that taste, if you want to put it that way, of academia, geared to our needs. We didn't do a lot of exams and writing, but we did have to do things for it. And that whetted that side of me, that kind of, I'm a Gemini, there's always two things going on. And so when I finished my teacher training, I decided to go to university and study for a degree in drama, because it was extremely unusual to have a practical training and university training. You had one or the other. And I thought it would satisfy that side of myself, and I thought it would be something rounded, I suppose, something more complete. So I then went and did 4 years and got a degree in drama and English. Couldn't do it in drama alone in those days. And because Glasgow University is peculiar and it was a four-year degree, you get an MA at the end of it. I always feel a little bit funny about when I, you know, if I do have to write my initials saying MA, because effectively it's an undergraduate degree. And I loved it. And I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to carry on here. And I was very lucky because as soon as I graduated, I was asked to come and work in the department as a graduate assistant cum tutor. So I did that part-time. I did some adult education part-time. And all the time I was waiting for a university full-time job to come up. And then in 1983, there was an advert in the paper for a lecturer in voice at the conservatoire. My mother said to me, have you seen the advert? And I said, yeah. She said, well, you know, apply, you've got nothing. And the rest is history. Not quite history, but I applied for it. And 6 months later, when a job did come up at the university, and I remember the moment very distinctly, I was sitting in the Athenaeum Theatre, because I was watching a student rehearsal. So there was a break, it was the interval. And my colleague who was watching with me said, well, the job's come up at the university, you're going to apply for it. And I said, no, this is where I want to be. And I just knew it in that moment. And the other, so that academic side has kind of surfaced in other ways, but I knew where I wanted to be and I felt I was in the right place. But I had to turn myself into a voice teacher, really. Because, well, for example, because I had spent this time, 5 years more studying since I did voice work, I thought, I don't know what to do. What do I do? Well, I had a wonderful, wonderful head of voice. And at that time, in that time, Cicely Berry's first book had come out. I knew things were changing. And she was very helpful, but very hands-off. I had to find my own way through it. And what she did do was supported each and every initiative that I might have about going to conferences, doing courses, reading, seeing, just I wanted to know everything I could know about voice. I spent quite a lot of time doing that, as well as I had to teach Scots language and literature. I had to do some work there. I had to teach radio, all things that I hadn't really done before. So it was a period of intense learning. And it's during that time that I met Cis and began a lifetime's connection with her, I suppose, because I went to do one of her weekend courses for teachers. So I saw the work in action. And Cis's work was really instrumental in helping actors connect with text. But the voice work was very much what I'd done. You lie on the floor, you open the body, your ribs, and so on and so forth. That her actual, when I look back, her actual voice exercises really were what we'd already been doing or in that tradition. My own little contention, or entirely wrong, was that she wasn't really interested in that. She was interested in articulacy and language and politics and poetry. And when you're a teacher, young teacher, I don't know how you would feel about it, you really start by teaching what you've been taught and in the way you've been taught. And I was doing all that and having, I don't know how you, successful results. The students did well, they learned, the feedback was good. I knew there was something missing, but I didn't know what it was. And I can talk about that
I'm just enjoying your story. I mean, I was immediately thinking something that I'll just, young teachers, it's interesting the idea that we often try and produce energy in a school by injecting young staff. And I've never quite heard that thought articulated, and this wasn't why you were articulating, but of course it's interesting that as people become more experienced in their teaching, they do tend to actually innovate and make work their own and find actually new things. I mean, it's a funny thought, isn't it, that perhaps an older teacher brings newer things than a
than a younger teacher, but that's just, maybe that's just my agenda, but it's interesting.
I think it is interesting. It maybe not applicable to every case, but no. I think there is something in it, and there was certainly something in it for me. It was only after a time that I just knew there was something missing. I thought there was something I wasn't getting to, and I had no idea what it was, but that's what it was. And I can tell you about...
tell me more about the show, because I know that we're listened to by lots of teachers, and so I'm really fascinated by this. So you knew there was something missing. Was that a thought? Was it a feeling? Was it a shape? Was it something you saw in people? What was its form to you? How did it communicate itself to you?
It was a feeling. It was an intuition. It was possibly as a frustration, which is a great spur to moving on. That is to say, just a way, I can't put it more than that. I would put it as an intuition and a feeling. Okay. A feeling there was something that I wasn't getting to. And I hadn't seen it, if I was honest, in all the other things that I had experienced. I'd gone to a voice workshop with Linklater or with other people at other conferences. They were all interesting, but I hadn't found it. I hadn't found it anywhere else, and I didn't find it in Cicely's voice work, although I was inspired by her text work, and she was very supportive of my journey without really wanting to know anything about it, but she was very supportive of me, let's put it like that. So you carry on. There were two things then. Oh, I should just say as a rider to that, which I didn't say when talking about my own voice work, we never had to lose our own accents. I think this is incredibly important. It's part of the democracy route as well. Mm. We learned RP. We had to know about it. But we didn't ever have to lose our accent. And this might have been different at the time if I had moved down south. I think it probably would have been. Not now, but I think at the time it might have been.
I think so.
Not that I wanted to or for various reasons, but it's about the valuing of everybody's voice, and that's going to come in really chimed a lot, if you like, with the sort of philosophy and the ideas in Nadine's work. So I feel I should say that. Two things were an influence at the time. One was something that an educationalist said to me, watching some of the work and all the rest of it within the school, and it may have been the time when we were beginning to think about degree awarding powers of our own. We were the first drama school in the country to be awarded our own degree awarding powers by the Privy Council. And I was part of that process. And he said to me something I have never, ever forgotten, which is education is a conversation between two generations about what is important.
Mm, beautiful.
And up to then, I thought I had to teach things. Me, teacher, knowledge things have to put into you, student, learning things. And he made me see something that was in my head. It was revolutionary. I don't know whether it was something he said or something somebody else had said, but it made a profound impact on me and was to have a profound impact on my teaching. The notion of the conversation. It was, ironically, it was Cis that put us together, Nadine and I. Mm. But I had connections with the Roy Hart. I wouldn't say I had connection with the Roy Hart Theatre as such, but I knew of it. And one of my fellow students at the conservatoire in the same year that I was training, Linda Wise, had gone off to join them. I think she had some family connection to them, but I'm not sure. So I knew about them and I'd read some things about them. And Linda had come to give sort of workshops or individual lessons at the school. And I was interested in them. I learned something from them. But again, it didn't impact on me the way Nadine's work was to impact on me. It was Sis that introduced us by letter. I have the letter, in which she said, oh, by the way, at the end of it, she was thanking me for, we had given her a fellowship of the Academy and I'd done the presentation. She was thanking me for that. And she said at the MP, so by the way, you can hear a voice in it. By the way, I met Nadine George of the Royal Heart Theatre and I think she might be interested in being in touch with you, something like that. And Linda had decided she wasn't going to give any more one-off workshops or lessons at the Conservatoire. She wanted a more in-depth teaching, length of teaching or block of teaching. Well, the Academy at the time had and continues to have at least 3 full-time voice teachers. We now have 4. And possibly didn't want to take on an addition. I don't know what the story was there, really. But the upshot of it was that she decided she wasn't going to work there. And Nadine, who knew her, of course, had been part of the Roy Hart Theatre. If you want me to say something about that later, I can. But Nadine had said to Linda, well, do you mind if I write to them? Because she was looking to come back to the country of her birth, where she was beginning to evolve her technique. And she was putting out feelers as to where she could work. And I got in touch with her, permission, my head of department, and said, come and give a workshop. Would like to come and give a weekend workshop. And students can volunteer for it, something like that. Which she did. We think 1990, we're a little hazy on it now, but we think 1990 she came and she gave a workshop to some of the students I was teaching. And her permission, I sat in, I watched it and I thought, that's it. I hadn't a clue what it was. Mm-hmm. And I probably didn't have it for the next 20 years. And maybe I'm not even sure now, but I knew what it was. I knew what it was when I saw it. I could see what she was in one half day able to release that I wasn't releasing or allowing my students to find. And I said to her, can I have a lesson? And she said, yes. And she gave me a lesson. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew at all levels that this was for me. It's not for everybody. We can discuss that, but it was for me because it made sense to me in my head, in my intelligence. It made sense to me in my body. It made sense to me in my mind, my body. It made sense in my heart. And I'm going to use a very unfashionable word, but you can use whatever word you like. It made sense in some way, although I didn't recognize it in my soul. In other words, in something that was an essential humanity or some level of spirit, let's put it like that, even if you don't like the word soul or whatever. And I might not have put it to myself at the time, but I felt it. And I felt and experienced my voice in a way that, although I had been deemed a good voice, I got good voice marks, in a way that I hadn't experienced before. And I thought, well, I have to find out about this.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's a fantastic story and point. And so do you think, and this is a real question, Roz, I'm thinking it might be really nice at this point for our listeners to track that point when you see Nadine work back through the line to Roy Hart and then to Alfred Wolfson. I'm thinking mm-hmm. some people won't know who Roy Hart is. So maybe, because that's an alternative. That tradition has nothing to do directly, although, of course, Roy Hart went to RADA and would have experienced that tradition at that point. In fact, he would have had Iris Warren, during the war, something I've often wondered about. But anyway, the line to Wolfson is an alternative tradition within the British Conservatoire. So would that be a useful thing at this point to explain that line?
So before I go right back to Wolfson, mm-hmm. let me say that this time of meeting of Nadine was when she was evolving her technique, her way of organising the work that she'd received. But she was trained in the mainstream English tradition. She was trained at Central as an actress, you would say. She had been taught by Gwyneth Thurburn. She'd been taught by Cicely Belly. That's why there was this connection in the first place. So she had all of that and all the passion for the text and the classical tradition and all the things that are implied by that. But she'd also been exposed to this other work, this European work. So now I'll go back into the European work. So the work originates, it has its root in the work, as you say, of Alfred Wolfson. And Alfred Wolfson was a German Jew. At the time of the First World War, he was conscripted into the war, 17 years old or thereabouts. And he was fighting in the trenches, so on. He was wounded on the battlefield. He was left there. He heard in the voices of the soldiers dying around him profound life, profound expression of the human being, the soul, he would say, in extremis. He was surrounded by this, people calling out for their mothers and people calling out to be saved. And it struck him, these voices struck him with their huge life in them and things that he heard that you don't hear unless you're in extremis. He was found, you know, he did survive. He was wounded, better. And in his life afterwards, he was trying to, I suppose you would say, trying to exorcise these sounds. He had these hallucinatory audible sounds that he couldn't get rid of. He was a singer, he was a musician. And he thought if he went to singing teachers and so on, he could maybe in that way heal himself. He found none of that worked. He said singing teachers concentrate on the larynx, but actually his discovery was that the voice is the expression of the psyche and of the individual's life, and therefore twiddling around with the larynx wasn't going to cut it. And he started to research his own work and to work with singers and so on. So for him, the voice was the muscle of the soul. That's, a Talmudic expression, not a new idea. Aristotle also said that, voice is the sound produced by a soul. So it's not, it's an old idea, an ancient idea. The voice was the audible expression of a person's inner being, and that everybody, and here we come to democracy again, everybody, every human being has creative potential. And potential in their life to be fully realized. So the root of the work is not an artistic practice initially. It's about common humanity. It's about the common humanity that we have, and voice as a way of what do you say? Your voice in your life and the life in your voice are completely indissoluble. That's his contribution to things. Funnily enough, last year, or no, maybe it was now the year before, maybe confused with COVID and timing, I went to Berlin. I was invited to Berlin along with the writer A.L. Kennedy, whom I've done a lot of work on the voice. We were invited to give a joint presentation to the Academie der Kunst. And while we were there, we took the opportunity to visit Wolfson's archive, which is held at the Berlin Jewish Museum. And there's a little bit of footage of him. There's not much, but there's a little bit of footage of him speaking and his work. So you see his energy, you hear his voice. Just things like looking at the notebook where he's written things. It was very moving to make contact with the root. And when we come to talk about tradition, we'll talk about the root or the source. So that was Wolfson. Of course, with the rise of the Nazis, he was Jewish. He had to come to he had to flee, basically, and he did. He came to London, like a lot of other people at the time, and he continued with his work there. Where Roy Hart comes in, Roy was a South African. He was also Jewish, actually. Came from a rabbinic family, but that's just as it is. He came to Rada. He came to Rada to train as an actor and was doing very well, did very well. But he felt there was something missing. Here we go. He felt there was something missing. The story goes, I don't know how true it is, but the story's been very often repeated, is that he was playing Othello in those days. We're talking about the 50s. He was playing Othello and it didn't feel real to him that he could kill Desdemona. He could kill anybody, actually. Now, how he came to Wilson, I'm not 100% sure, but he came to him for a lesson or whatever. And Wilson worked with him for an hour and a half, 2 hours. And by the end of it, the story goes, Roy Hart was ready to kill him. And then he realised he had tapped artistically what that was and could use it. In other words, there was a channel for it artistically that he could take into his work. It was Roy, I think you would say, who took the work into artistic contexts, though the whole establishment, the Roy Hart Theatre and everything, very 60s, very, you know, communal living and all that sort of thing. They went off to France. That story is very well told. You can look it up. There you would say the work was experimental. It was a laboratory for a new theatre. And there, the voice work, which was true of Wolfson too, was about extending the range, sounds outside the normal human range, sounds that would not be considered aesthetically beautiful but were expressive, connected to, perhaps too connected to the life of the people doing it. You might, that's possible, at that time. Nadine, who had come across Roy Hart performing with this work in London and was hugely struck by it and knew that she had in her own voice training, knew there was a disconnect between her and her voice or something missing, went to work with him and then went and became part of the Roy Hart Theatre. So she experienced all that extended work on the voice and the European context of it. But when she came back this country, I was thinking of coming back this country towards the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, she knew she wanted to bring those two sides of her together. The classical tradition of the text that hadn't really been a feature, particularly of the Roy Hart work, and the work that she'd been given. But she said to me, it was unusable in the form that I had inherited the work. I had to find a way of distilling it or of making it simpler or of evolving a simple technique so that the work would lead right through to text and performance in a different way, in a way that celebrated classical texts, particularly Shakespeare. And that's when she started to research her technique at Birmingham University, invited her to come and do that. And it was about that time that we had our first meeting. So Nadine, there's an interesting small piece about this in Jane Boston's book about voice, where she put some sort of under extreme trainings. She puts Wilson, she puts Roy Hart, she puts Nadine, and she includes me. But what I would say is, while that was certainly true of Wilson and Hart, while one could say to an extent it's true of Nadine, but one has to point to the fact that Nadine has also worked in traditional national drama schools in Europe and theatre companies. So where text is absolutely crucial, and certainly in my own work it is. So I think we've moved from a sort of laboratory thing. She ends that section by talking about pitch, which it isn't. I think there's a perception it might all be about loud sound or odd sound or extended sound, but actually, we wouldn't have survived within conservatoire training and within the profession if that's what we've been doing, because it's no longer, let's say, it's no longer laboratory theatre, it's no longer experimental, and in fact has been mainstream in Scotland for 30 years. Is there something else that you want to know in terms of that lineage for the moment? Nadine didn't work with Wilson, he was not alive by then, or certainly not teaching by then, but she worked with Hart. And then, as I've explained to you, Nadine and I met when she came to work at the conservatoire.
No, that's brilliant. And also really, really clear that that movement from something which is therapeutic or exploratory into something which is artistically avant-garde, into something which has an application into the conservatoire, the sort of actor training. And then, of course, no, it's really interesting that you even that line even goes to what your work as opposed to Nadine's work. And then, as I was saying in the beginning, I think I'll probably cut it and just start with you talking, Ros, because I'm fascinated listening to you. But I also teach the work in my own way, an iteration, which is a further iteration, which has been a part of the BAs at RADA and Lambda in a way which is it's very much a part of their voice training, to use their voices in all kinds of ways for all kinds of media, from audiobooks to big theatres. So for me, it's become entirely a part of voice pedagogy in sort of flected, is that a word? I think it's a word, isn't it? With the spirit or something that I feel I've learned from you and learned from Nadine, and that I suppose goes back, but I think that's a brilliant introduction.
I'm really interested in that, actually, because I want this to be a conversation, and I'll come back to the notion of conversation rather than just about me. And I'm really interested just to, because you're telling me this, but I haven't had the experience of seeing your work or understanding quite how it interfaces with the other work that you might do or the context in which you're doing the work. And there are other people teaching now in drama schools in England and so on. They're sort of moving out there. And, of course, some of the other schools do have more exploratory work, the Roy Hart Theatre work. But I'm interested in this from your point of view, because I'm quite moved by that. I'm quite taken aback by that the interactions that we've had have in some way impacted on your teaching or how you teach or what you teach. I just wonder if you could say something about that before
Okay. No, I'd be delighted to. And I think the work that I've encountered with you and Nadine has actually been really important to lots of my students. So I think that when you were speaking, I was thinking about the effect it's had on them. And I know in both those schools when I taught to them, especially at Lambda, where I'd sort of developed it to a point where it was sitting very securely in me, I think. Often were students would tell me that those classes have been crucial to them, to their development as actors, and I think also as people. So I think what happened to me is that I started using the first sort of series of exercises, which I think I started calling the work in pairs. I would always acknowledge where I'd got it from. I'd always talk about you, but it sort of became something else, partly because I'm also a Qigong teacher. So I have a practice in Qigong, and I felt that those two things worked very nicely together. So I think I was teaching a kind of a version of the first sequence, which I called the pair work, the breathing work. I was teaching that very much with a light language of Qigong. So I would talk about energy and I would talk about how the hands work, which I think is also probably a part of the work as I had it. I can't now remember where my work begins and the work I have from you starts. I can't quite remember what's mine and what's yours. I was actually thinking I'd love to do, and when all this is over, I'd love to work with you or Nadine again to find out. Actually, I'd be really fascinated. I've had the same experience with other teachers where I've gone back and done something with David or even just spoken to a teacher, and you realize that phrases you have or ideas that you've taken possession of are actually connected to them. So I do less of the voicing, actually. So what I would tend to do, what became a regular class in my teaching, was to do a version of the work in pairs work. And I think the reason why it became so important to me is I felt it permitted all movements in the same way that, and I think I've taught this less well, although it's become a part of how I think about the voice, your work permits all sound. And so I remember going through a 2-week training and realizing at the end of it that I never really judged my voice again. I never minded the things that it did. I love the way that Nadine would sort of find a part of the voice which in other contexts would be seen as ugly, perhaps, And that would be the point of exploration. That would be the door that was opened. And then you would go into that and you would explore it and you would allow it to blossom. And I just thought that was a sort of a I don't think it's not really a metaphor. It's a lesson, a wonderful lesson to realize that the voice is full of vast potentialities. And as you say, is an expression of us. And all of those are valid and all of them have a place and a purpose. And I think I think I'm a very bad voice teacher. So I've always worked mostly physically. I really see the voice almost more than I hear it. So to permit people's breath and sort of movement of the body in service of sound, to have the same complete permission and to say that there's no good place or bad place, there are only places, and that if we open them all up, I also have a sort of Feldenkrais background, and I think maybe it connects to Feldenkrais to me, the idea that if you open up all the possibilities, all the things that the human body and voice can do, then on a given day, if you're working with a microphone, well, you have the options from which to select, not consciously, not in a kind of crafty way, but almost more because of the task. You fulfill the thing you're doing because you've developed a great palette, really. And so, and also I think politically, and it's fascinating to me that you talk about democracy, because for me, I've always been uncomfortable with the idea of telling anybody which pattern they should use. And I could see in the bodies of my students that their history and their culture sometimes was a part of how they use themselves. And that although I feel there's a positive politics in inviting other possibilities into bodies, I was never going to tell people that what they were doing with themselves was wrong and that they should do this. And I felt this way for over 20 years. So I think, as often happens with teachers, you find the teacher you need to find.
I think you're absolutely right about the non-judgmental aspects of the work, which are crucial because we monitor and judge ourselves all the time, students particularly, and are they, you know, measuring up this or that, consciously or unconsciously, as you say, do we give them patterns and so on. So I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think this, people respond to the freedom that whatever exists in that moment of breathing or voicing is right for that individual. And you take it from there. And so we will maybe come to pedagogy in terms of, I said to you, the conversation between two generations, that's usually teacher and student, about what is important. But I would go further. I would say that the person who has the voice is the person who knows best what it needs, not me. They may not know consciously, sometimes it's unconscious or not at that level of consciousness, but it's not just a meeting of equals, although it is a meeting of equals, and nothing in the way that I was taught, however benevolent, was really a meeting of equals. It was still on the pattern of me have the knowledge, I give it to you, and so on. I'm not saying there's not respect in that, but it wasn't equal. I would say this is almost the other way. And that if I put it in my own context, what I'm doing is simply, I have just done more of this work than the person standing in front of them. So I just bring that to bear if it's useful on my understanding of what's going on. But the real work is in the listening and the watching, the listening, what the human being in front of me is transmitting to me, what I'm transmitting to that human being, very important. The creation of a context where the individual feels safe enough, free enough to be who they are, so the voice can be what it really is, not what they think it should be, not what someone tells them it should be, not what the criticisms they've had of their voice or anything else that colours that, but what the reality is. And that person knows somewhere, or let's say the body knows, however you want to put that, I'm not a scientist, but there is that is inside. And what you're simply doing is creating trying to create a space for it to come to consciousness for that person and what they're doing. And sometimes you this comes back to bearing witness. Sometimes you're just receiving. And I very often say, and I mean it, I'm just playing the notes. Because they'll say to you, oh, thank you, and you're doing this. And I can't do it that way for anybody. Can't do it. Even if I wanted to, I can't. All I'm saying is, let me play the notes. You're doing it. You're doing it for yourself. And you're doing it because you need to at that moment. Well, the voice is expressing what it's expressing at that moment, whether you want it to or not. The voice will have a voice. And that real voice, not the performed voice, the covered voice, the learned voice or anything else, that voice will have its voice in one way or another. Better it should come out as expression than in the other ways it comes out in life, which are perhaps sometimes more harmful. So that changes the pedagogy, changes how you teach. We can come back to it. That's my thought about it. That's what I think as a teacher, that I don't know more about what this person is in themselves or has in their voice until it's expressed. And I will say to the person, but I don't know what's in your voice. How do I know what's in the depths of a human being? I don't. I just am aware of the person standing in front of me in that moment. And the next it could be different and so on. And I have to listen to that and I have to be aware of what I'm transmitting in order for that person to see what the possibilities, you know, what their voice is telling them. And it's not what your brain is telling you about the voice. It's what your voice is telling you about yourself. And it's not a process for everybody. I have to say that because you have to confront yourself. You have to confront things in yourself. They will come up. We have our sorrows. We have our difficulties. We have whatever life's thrown at us. And that's not for everybody. And not every voice teacher wants that. But your life is implicated in your voice. And my life has to be implicated in my teaching or my encounters, my voice work. I can't shut myself off from that. It's not about imposing anything on anybody else, but I have to know where I stand in myself. And that comes from just having, not just, but having been on that journey. So I have that when I'm listening to somebody and making perhaps a suggestion or encouraging the voice to go in that moment, as you say, through a difficult part or whatever it is, it's because I know it can be done. And I know it can be done in that person at that moment, even though they don't think so. And that's very, very important that you have faith in the process, but I have faith in the human being at that moment. I have faith in them that they can do it because I hear it just before they do it. I sense it just before they do it. That's just being steeped in the technique. And so, that's probably enough on that actually at the moment while I gather something else about it. So in terms of where we're still talking about tradition, we're talking about Olson and Hart and George. In terms of the transmission from Nadine to me, which I've explained to you, was just profound because I recognised my voice. My voice was me, totally unmediated with everything that I have and I am. My point of difference, probably, or development, if you want, was that I was able through a conjunction of factors to take the work, to find a place for the work in professional theatre contexts in Scotland. And it was as a result of that that I had the confidence to really bring it back into the conservatory, to establish it, because it had professional credibility. And that's very important. It's not a thing in isolation. And I was lucky on a, well, I consider myself very lucky with where I was employed as a voice person. But I would say there were three particular influences. One was not because voice work was of any interest whatsoever to the triumvirate at the Citizens Theatre under Giles Havergarbit in that part. Of a fantastic era in that theatre. You'll notice called a Citizens Theatre. This is Glasgow, this is democracy. I did work with Giles himself, and I did do some work on the others, Philip Prowse and Robert David McDonald's productions, but predominantly I was working with the next generation of directors, which was fascinating. They couldn't have been probably less interested in voice work than anything else. But in working on the texts, and I was working on some very wacky and strange texts and new texts as well as classics, in working on the text, I brought the work that I brought what I understood about energies and qualities of the voice. So that was a very important starting place. That's where I started really working in theatre as a voice specialist. The Traverse was a huge influence on me, and I cannot give more gratitude for having met Philip Howard, who was the associate director. Actually, I think he was probably the associate director before he became artistic director. Was a wonderful influence. That's where I met John Tiffany and went on with this work with him. And it was all new writing. It was all texts that had to be excavated and so on. And I was lucky enough to work on a whole generation, a whole golden age of writing, if you want to put it that way. This is where your David Greggs and your David Harrowers, and I don't want to mention names, it's invidious to mention names, but that generation, and subsequently on Youngers too. And the third one was Nicola McCartney, who was running a theatre company at the time. She was the assistant director or something on the theatre version of Trainspotting, and I'd gone in to do some work with her. And she was and is a great champion of the work, and she's a writer. I've worked with many writers and their own voices. It was an effect in her writing. She was a theatre director. She had a theatre company, and she's been a very solid friend and supporter of the work. So these that entry into professional theatre was very important, but it really... The next phase of it, if you want, it began with the reincarnation of David Harrow's incredible first play, Knives and Hens, which had been successful. I'd worked on the studio version of it. It was moving into the big theatre. And in the remount of it, Philip invited me to come in and work with him again. I said, actually, I want to do something else, if you don't mind. I said, I want to work on the voices using some of this work. The work was being remounted. They were all three actors. They were all ex-students, although they hadn't necessarily all had the work. Two of them had done the play before, so there was a third one that was being integrated in the cast, and the set was already there. Lots of things were already in place. I said, I want to do this work every day. I want to do the voice work with them and bring that to bear on this text, which is a very, very spare text, if you know it. It's a fantastic text, but it's got icebergs. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, we had a different spine-tingling, as I remember it still, relationship in the rehearsal room between director and voice specialist, between what I was doing and where it was leading each of us. David was in the room, and David just said to me at the end, he said, you've just got into my subconscious. I said, well, I don't know about that, but let's just do the work. And we just went on doing the work. And from then on, I used the work on almost every show that Philip directed there. And of course, John was there. I started to work on John's productions too. And it culminated in, fact, Philip and I co-directing Solemn Mass for a full moon summer, Trombley played, translated into Scots. So what that was the voice technique that I was using, this Nadine George work, became a medium of rehearsal. It was part of the way the play was rehearsed. It wasn't warming up the actors. It wasn't taking them away. It wasn't doing dialect work. That's a different thing. It was actually part of the way it's rehearsed in front of the director, sharing the territory of the text. And it modelled a new role for the voice specialist in production as a creative collaborator. And I think voice people are not always creative collaborators in the process. There's something about how voice, what status a voice person is given and what status a movement person is given. That's an aside, but you will always find people credited as movement director and you end up with something like voice coach, or if you say voice director, people come out in hives. Not in America, there's a different book about that called Voice Direction in Theatre. But the word director, because it's to do with text, can send some directors into hyperventilating, whatever that is. Anyway, that's what happened within, and because of that credibility in the profession, I was able to bring it more substantially back into the conservatoire. And my head of department had left by then, and Maggie Kinloch, who was running the school at the time, said she was reorganising the school. She'd just come in. We're not going to have departments. No voice department, no movement department. It's all going to be in programmes or whatever. And I thought, oh, my dead body. And I wrote, I thought, what, with all this work behind us and work my colleagues were doing and all the rest of it. And I wrote a whole piece about it. I said, this is why we have to have a voice department. This is what we're doing. We're researching the voice work. We have distinctive work. We have professional work, so on and so on. And I gave it to her. And she called me in for a meeting and she said, thank you very much. She said, we're still not going to have a voice department, at which point I thought, right, I'm leaving, I'm off. You know. She said, we're going to have a centre for voice and performance for the teaching, practice and research of the work. She said, and you're going to lead it. She said, because not only are we doing this teaching and we are researching it and you're researching it in artistic context, but because the profession will totally understand why we're having it. And that mattered to us. So once the centre was set up, which was the same year as the National Theatre of Scotland, 2006, and it was me in charge because my head of department had retired, I made that work central for all students. Whereas it had been running alongside, my head of department taught the mainstream work in first year, and then the students had this work in second and third year, although they had workshops with Nadine through all 3 years. And that's a different story, how it was actually built at the conservatoire. That's my contribution to the tradition.
Yeah, so from 2000, fantastic. Did we say 2006? Was that the date or earlier?
The centre was set up in 2006 and the National Theatre of Scotland was established in 2006, yeah.
So from 2006 until, and is that work, is the work still the centre of the voice training now?
The work is still the centre of the voice training. It's not that students don't get introduced to other things, but it was also expanded so that our musical theatre students did the work, the performance practice students did the work, the MA directors did the work. It was opened right out because of a big curriculum. We underwent a big curriculum, huge curriculum reform, written branch, change within the conservatoire, because we added different, just we had dance, we had film and TV, we had traditional Scottish music, we had jazz, we had so many things. So we had to re-look at what the curriculum was, what conservatoire was, and I think the centre and the centre's work contributed a lot to that. So it's still ongoing. Nadine's work, I mean, it's over 30 years. Nadine first came and did workshops from 1990 onwards. She was invited back, and gradually those moved from a weekend to a week to a block of 3 weeks to coming twice a year. And that was extended to staff because the thrust of the curriculum reform was to do with interdisciplinarity and collaborative practice. That really pushed the curriculum on into kind of the 21st century, I suppose you would say. And so staff were offered, not just voice staff, staff were offered the work that they wanted to, and a lot of staff did. So we had a musical, someone who teaches musical direction, the musical directors did the work. We had the principal did the work. That was huge. John Wallace was the principal at the time, and he's an artist. He's a world-class trumpeter. And as an artist and the principal, he understood the work and championed it. So it was open to a lot of people.
Yeah. I think for anyone listening, I suspect that they'll be wondering what the work is. So I wonder if...
Yes.
No, I just wonder if... No, it's so interesting. If that maybe for this last... And maybe I'm just keeping an eye on the time and thinking about, I don't think I'm going to want to cut anything you've said, Roz. So if we were aiming for an hour and a half podcast, something along those lines, which I think is a good length for a proper one of these, maybe for this section anyway, could you take us through the work? Don't teach us it, of course. And I'm wondering if you have observations about the different phases, because like all great work, I think it's both... On the surface, it can look very simple. I'm thinking that more and more, I think that's true for the things that really work in terms of maybe learning anything, but certainly in drama schools. And it's a process, and it's sort of beautifully shaped. I think it's got a wonderful shape. And so I wonder if you could take us sort of through the shape of the work when you talk about the work, what we're actually talking about. And then if anything comes up about observations you've had with particular students, if there are any stories you have structured within your description of the, I know I'm rather putting you under a sort of performance. Anyway, tell us about the work, and if that happens, I'd love to hear those stories.
Well, the description of the work that I would give is that it's a process that exposes the realities of the voice, makes manifest this indissoluble connection between a person and their voice. So it's not a sound shaped by an aesthetic, which I think we've probably established. And in doing so can bring about transformative change. So we're looking for the reality of the voice, the real voice, not, as I said before, the covered voice, the performed voice, the image of the voice, and all these things that get in the way of people when they think about their voice, start to work with their voice. And the judgment that gets in the way, the monitoring, the judgment, the critical voice in the head. The actual process, which has been written down when it's available, you could teach the basics in an hour and a half. And some people would have an hour and a half and then think, right, I can go off and teach this. And you're thinking, no, you won't, because, yes, you can do a certain amount and it will have a certain effect. But then what? You can only take people as far as you've gone. What it is in the way that Nadine evolved it, the peer work that you describe, you can have an individual lesson. Generally, people experience it first, a workshop or a group. Certainly, students would experience it as a group. The peer work is about the contact, the internal contact with your own breath and energy deep in the body. There are two breathing sequences. The first one is you lie down on your back. You open the body, you breathe out. The emphasis is always in breathing out. There's nothing about ribs, diaphragm, twiddling this, that muscle. I don't know about the muscles. I've long forgotten about muscles. But I'm breathing out. But you breathe out on the vowel O. So there's an opening of the mouth, the lips come forward, and you hear the breath sound in the body. You neither are producing the sound nor silent. And while you're going through that very simple process with your eyes closed, you encourage just to breathe out, breathe down into the body. Your partner will be contacting you in different ways just to help you open and relax. So they might just hold your head in their hands. They might release a stroke up the back of your neck. They might just open your shoulders. They might put a hand on the breastbone. All the time you're breathing down in the body, and then they'll come around and work with your legs. So you take the breath really, don't take the breath really deeply down. You're breathing out from a very deep, from deep down in yourself. That's the process. And you accept that sometimes the mind can't shut off. That's also very important. Sometimes the mind will chunter on, You have to learn to just accept that and breathe out with it and not worry that you may be jumping to your thoughts or you may be trying to work out what it is. You have to try not to work out what it is, but that will happen. So you just have to accept that. And gradually, gradually, organically, that will find its place. Then you open the eyes, you stop working, or someone will stop working with you. You open your eyes and you continue to breathe out. But you now have an external connection to the world, which you don't want to change, this internal connection to the self. And that's the process beginning of taking it out into the world. You will roll over, you'll come up in a certain way, and then you'll work to open that breath and energy in a more with more power, your own sort of internal power of the breath and energy. And then you will work with focus. The ocular vocal connection is very strong in this technique. And as a sideline, one of my colleagues who did some work with EMDR, this psychotherapeutic technique that uses the eyes, it was interested in it because she found that our students didn't suffer in general from stage fright. That's a really interesting thing. It's to do with the eye connection, which I'd never had before in voice work, the eye connection. Then the group will link those energies together. They'll breathe together in the room. Oh, you'll swap round the pairs, obviously, and then the group will do some work together to open breath and energy. And then you take it out into the space. So that you walk out, the walking out into the space, the focus of the eyes, the breath coming forward, all this opens together because you can't act in theatre lying down on the floor. Have to take it out. And all the time there's an energy movement. And then the group will come back together and you'll generally find that the connection with their breath together as a group is of a particular order. It's moved on, which is very often why directors want this work, by the by, because it can unify a company or bring them all into the same energy place. And that's particularly important for actors of different generations, I think. That's what you would do. And then you warm up the voice. And the warm-up is Nadine's work is four qualities of sound, she will call, or four energies that are present in everybody's voice. She will call them two male and two female. That can be a little bit contested these days, but she will add a rider as to why they're that and the permission to call them what you want. So that actually, whatever you call them, you're working with the qualities of the energy and the sound, whatever you want to call them. Although, of course, the democracy is in the fact that everybody has both in different balances. So it's accepting of all of that. But the terminology these days, you know, that's just something else. You will warm up the voice, very simple, on the piano, middle C, generally speaking, for women's voices. It just depends. And the C below middle C, generally speaking, for men's voices, but that can, you know, there's a flexibility in that. And you will just do a few notes on the scale of C. The notes are not being sung. And this is another thing that you have to clear out of the head. The notes are not being sung. They're a means of opening energy. So the irony is that we're not interested in pitch. A person's pitch can be completely off, but they're opening a huge energy. And in time, that will also coincide with pitching to the note, but it's of no interest really whatsoever. They're just there as a means to open the voice, to open energy. And then you will work in an individual quality of sound in a more extended way than the few warm-up notes. And as you've already said, anything that happens in the voice is absolutely not to be judged or cut out or monitored. The voice may crack, the voice may have broken chords in it, the voice may be expressing something that you think aesthetically, as you say, is not attractive. All of these considerations have to be put aside, or learn to put them aside bit by bit. And in the opening of the voice, although you have four different qualities, they actually are all, of course, totally interconnected. They're totally individual to a person, what that mix is. And you work through, it sounds really simple, it is simple, you work through the notes of the major scale, you may take it up a bit further, you may go into parts, depending on what's opening, because the singing of these sounds coming from the body and this deep body connection to the creative source, to your breath, to your energy, these sounds will produce or can lead to openings in the individual. They might lead to thoughts, they might lead to emotional openings, openings of feeling. They might take them to a part they've never thought they could reach. And at the same time as you're working with that, you have to work with the individual's, or an individual has to work with what is stopping them. What are the breaks on what they're doing? What are the things they think they can't do? And you say, just go. And this is where you find a way of just allowing them to go through the opening. So you might hit a sort of crack in your voice or an ugly voice. That will be the moment of creative change and transformation in this technique. And you would say, go into it. Don't go away from it. Go into it. And of course, it leads to another opening. And these openings that happen for people mean you go to a different creative level, when you work through on your life. And that is what gives you the power to stand in yourself and take that into your work artistically and take it into your life. So from the individual openings of the sound, you go immediately to text. Actually, I should have said I've missed a step, which is when you're doing the vocal warm-up, each vocal quality is linked to a line of Shakespeare text. You immediately take it into the word. After you've done the vocal exploration, most people are then working on text of some kind, whether it's something they're writing, whether it's something they're seeing, a dramatic text that they're working on. And when you put the voice through these openings, through these spectrums, say I'm working with an actor, say we take Knives and Hens, so for a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever it was, every day they're doing a different quality, every day that's opening something in the sound, every day that goes into the text, and the transmission of the text in that moment, that live transmission and with the other actor and the reception of that, so on, it opens possibilities. The possibilities, as you said before, are not, I would say it's not so much about a palette to select from. I would say they're all there. And in the moment, the directness of the living moment, you access something, but the ghost of the other possibilities are behind it. So you have something very layered and a performance is very textured. And then these things can come in at different moments at different times. The possibilities are not so much a selection, but you have explored them all through the body and voice. This is why it can short circuit a lot of rehearsal, a lot of sitting around the table, a lot of talking, a lot of head work. Sorry if you say that. And the creativity of the individual and the expression of the creativity happens simultaneously. And that's the transmission between actors. If I'm asked to open out a scene between the actors, we'll work that way on the energies of it. Not what you think your character might do or say, but what is the energy in the writing of the text that meets you and opens the character? Have I explained that reasonably enough? Well, I've written about it, so
yeah. No, I know, and it's nice to hear it expressed. And that's completely, well, it's very clear to me, having had some experience. But and I think for anyone else, that would be really useful, actually, and generous, Roz, to take us through that. When I've got a question, I might snip this. I'm curious. This is this thing about what I've added and what I've learned. When exploring the voice qualities, and I've encountered people ask questions about the naming of them as well, including a voice and language therapist I know who works a lot with trans people and has asked about that. Do you encourage the students to physically, to kind of express physically as well as vocally? Is that a part of that, or do they do it in a sort of standing simplicity?
It depends. What I would say is, at first, the movement is more limited. You would do it sitting down on a chair, bringing the energy through the text, because you want to take away extraneous acting type things. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you can be quite strict about this. Don't use your hands.
Oh, yeah.
Just stay, just, you don't have to be a dummy, but no extraneous movement. So the energy goes into the voice. Once you start taking away those things, then we go into the voice. So you will start people off maybe sitting on chairs, but the energy exchange. Once that opens, you can get someone to stand up and what that brings to it, and then move with it. But what you find is the impulse for the movement is coming from this connection with the text and voice. And you'll suddenly see it. You'll see an impulse in the body to move in a particular way, or to something happening in the body. I will give you an example. You asked me about a particular example. One sticks in my mind. I was working with John Tiffany in a piece of research with the directors. So a lot of actors have this work. I wanted to work with directors so that, and they were all directors initially who had had the work or seen the work at some point in the rehearsal room, were interested to know, I guess, how they might put it, how I was getting to what I was getting. I don't know. But something they understood. And I did a piece of research, which I've written about this. And so I put the directors, or asked the directors, put them, they chose, to go through the process, not as a director, i.e. not thinking, try not to judge it, try not to think how you might use it, just experience the work. Okay, that will come later. And we were working on a monologue, and John was working on a monologue of Richard III, and he didn't particularly know the play. But he comes from Yorkshire, it's quite interesting. And as he was working on his monologue through the week, I cannot tell you, but there was a moment at which he transformed into what he called afterwards a boar, a male pig. And it was astonishing physical transformation, though he wasn't thinking about doing that. He was just going to the voice. And his body started to distort. It was organic, let me put it like that. It wasn't a head thing, it wasn't a planned thing, it wasn't an acting thing. It came through his connection with the words. His accent became much stronger. His Yorkshire accent became much stronger. And something organic happened to the body. So I think that's the paradigm is the right word, but that's how the movement happens. And then you move in, if you're doing a scene, you move it in the space. You move it in the space with connected impulse. Thereafter, there may be a selection. That's when the director comes in and says, that's a great moment when this... So on. Eventually, for a performance, you will select. But it comes, like so many other things in the technique, it comes organically. That's what you're trying to... not interfere with that process, but allow that organic connection.
Great. Lovely. I think that's probably a good place to conclude, certainly for today. Is there anything you'd like to add? Anything you've missed you'd like to bear witness to? Anything you'd like to add?
I would like to just say one thing. Tradition that, because this is where we came in, tradition that doesn't meet its times fossilizes. Tradition has to be living, and transmission is an important part of this technique. Transmission is an important part of it. But I would also like to tell you or say that the work, as the work has gone on, it has to meet its times. There are developments in it, that we interrogate this work the whole time. One of its characteristics is that the teachers do the work themselves. And that notion of reassessing, and where are we now, and did what work then work now, because you can't always, and you shouldn't always recapture, has led to an evolution in the technique. So even now, it's not exactly the same as it was when Nadine first introduced me to it. There are changes and movements, and that's to do with the conversation with the people, the students, actors, whoever, with the people to whom the voice belongs. Mm. That's the conversation.
Mm. Yeah. No, thank you. Because I certainly don't feel in any have any urge to sort of argue for or defend tradition as a stuck thing. It's precisely that conversation, that dialogue between evolution and tradition via transmission in the field of the work that we do. And I completely
you have to have respect for the source and the root, but that respect needn't be a duty. It has to meet its times.
Mm, that's nice.
It has to meet its times because we only live in the now of our lives.
Mm.
It has to meet who's meeting it now.
Thank you, Roz. That was wonderful. It's funny when you were describing the work, you know, that curious thing was happening to me that I was sort of living it in myself, remembering things somatically. It was lovely, actually. Thank you so much.
Thank you for asking me.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. I can't wait to get it out. I'm going to stop recording now. Also, partly because then I know it's...